May it please the court, my name is Kelsey Bolger on behalf of Ms. Ashley White.
Okay, you're going to have to speak up a little bit.
Microphones
aren't working today.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
The error presented in this appeal is that there was insufficient evidence at trial to find Ms. White guilty of child abuse and neglect under 371.1 subsection A. The case before the court today is not about an abusive or neglectful parent. Rather, it's about a tragic accident that led to the death of a young child. At trial, to convict Ms. White, the Commonwealth first had to prove a willful act or a willful omission. This court and the Supreme Court of Virginia have consistently defined willful as an act done with a bad purpose, without ground for believing it is lawful. And this court, as well as the Supreme Court, have consistently said that a finding of willfulness necessarily requires that the accused have knowledge that the harm is probable rather than just possible.
It's correct, counsel, that you say that there's a component of willfulness in the analysis that we have to pursue in this case, but we go back to the old statement that a person intends the natural and probable consequences of their acts. And in this case, contrary to maybe some of the other cases we've heard today, there was a suggestion that this was a known circumstance. In other words, the fact that this child apparently had free rein to go here and there and everywhere, and the fact that this septic system was not always secure was known to Ms. White, and still necessary precautions and were not taken to ensure that this child was safe. What would be your response to that?
So I would disagree with the characterization of the court's findings that this was known to Ms. White that the septic tank was unsecured. The Commonwealth in its brief and even the trial court in its factual findings seemed to find that the mere existence of the septic tank on this property is what presented the danger. We don't actually have any evidence in the record of how the septic tank was secured prior to March 22nd or even...
How did the toys get into it?
So we have a septic tank that has been on this property for about 10 years prior to Ms. White living there. We have testimony from the septic tank technician who pumped the actual tank that says, I didn't notice any toys. And then we have Ms. White's own statements of the landlord complaining about toys and cigarette butts in the septic tank. Ms. White herself in the interview says, we were flushing cigarette butts down the septic tank. So we have no evidence as to what the actual toys were, how long they had been in the septic tank, the size of them, if they were flushed down the toilet.
But given that it's your client relaying a statement from her current landlord, doesn't that suggest that somehow, isn't it a reasonable inference for the fact finder to conclude that somehow toys are presently going in the septic tank and that's why he basically told her to stop?
So that toys were in the septic tank, yes, but not that the septic tank had been opened up by the child and toys put in. We have complaints about, I believe it was cigarette butts, tampons, and toys going down the toilet.
It suggests that there are two reasonable ways for those toys to have gotten there, flush them down the toilet, or it's an unsecure lid. But given that we also know that the lid is unsecure, can the fact finder put those two inferences together?
So no, because we have no evidence about how long that lid was actually unsecured. We also don't have any evidence about how the lid was even secured on March 22nd. We have some testimony that there was one screw in, but not holding the screw in. We don't know if that was a new circumstance. The Commonwealth, in its brief, says we have no evidence that Mr. Meadows negligently maintained that septic tank.
Can I bring you back maybe to a very fundamental question? We're talking about the facts, but I need to get my head around the legal standards, the mens rea in this statute. Subsection A prohibits a willful act or a willful omission. Subsection B prohibits a willful act or an omission in the care that was gross, wanton, culpable, basically criminally negligent. So it looks to me like B criminalizes, in this case, which is an omission, criminally negligent omission, which suggests to me that A has got to have some higher mens rea.
I'm not sure that that's necessarily true, and that's because subsection A requires a causation of serious harm, whereas I believe subsection B goes on to say willful, wanton disregard for human life.
But don't, I mean, the fact that the General Assembly chose not to insert the word willful in front of omission in B1 suggests to me that there's a difference between the omission in A and the omission in B. The omission in B can be criminally negligent. Suggests to me that the omission in A has to be, the willful in that has to be a higher intent, a higher standard.
And I certainly think that's true, that in subsection A, whether we're talking about an act or we're talking about an omission, at this point it's very clear that the omission also has to be willful. The General Assembly has amended the statute to reflect that. So I do think that it is very clear here that willfulness is required whether it's an act or omission.
Failure to secure the septic tank seems to be kind of the willful omission path for the Commonwealth. The willful act seems to be taking a medication and falling into such a deep sleep that you could not be. And going to those cases, we kind of have Barrett as one bookend that says sleep, heavy sleep induced by the abuse of a substance, intoxication at the point of passing out, is sufficient to be a willful act. We have Morris that says sleep without ingestion of any substance, but it doesn't say abuse of a substance. It says without use of a substance is not. And it seems to me that this case is somewhere in between because it is sleep with the use but not abuse of a substance. Given those distinctions, is this Barrett or is it Morris or is it something? Is it a third thing altogether?
So I actually think when analyzed in that way, just analyzing her actions in a vacuum, it's certainly less egregious than Morris. Your Honor mentioned that she was in a deep sleep. I would, of course, disagree with that. She awoke when the baby monitor went off. But that's why it's so difficult. Her actions cannot be analyzed in a vacuum. We have to think about what knowledge she had of any probable danger at the time when she took her prescribed medication and when she went to sleep. Now, the defendant in Barrett, her actions were so egregious because just days prior, she had seen her daughter attempt to harm her son in the exact same way that actually killed her son. So combining that knowledge with her coming home and passing out after a full night of drinking and leaving her children unsupervised, the court said, of course she was on notice that that would happen. That was willful conduct. But it wasn't just falling asleep and being intoxicated. Whereas in Morris, despite the fact that her children had escaped the home on prior occasions, the Supreme Court said there is no reason for that mother, when she fell asleep, to think her children would be in any danger, because there was no indication that when they left the home on the prior occasion, there was no danger presented. So the actions, I think, have to be analyzed in terms of what danger the defendant was actually aware of at the time.
Isn't that danger basically a notice component? In other words, requiring the fact finder to make a determination of some sort of notice adherent to the failure to act. And in this case, the analysis was that she was aware that the child got away. She was aware that the child was near the septic system. She was aware that there was some risk associated with this, but yet and still we ended up with the consequences that we're confronted with here today.
And I think that argument depends on allowing the trial court to find that the mere presence of a septic tank in a home is a probable danger to the child. And that's simply not accurate. There is nothing inherently dangerous about a septic tank in the home. They're very common waste disposal systems.
There's something inherently dangerous, though, to a septic system that is unsecure when you have a toddler that has shown a proclivity to going out there and being around that unsecure septic system.
So we have a child who's nearly 6 years old that enjoys playing in the yard. We don't have any evidence that the child had been in danger near the septic tank before. We don't have any evidence that the child or anyone else in the home or anyone else that had ever lived there had almost fallen into that septic tank before. Further, we don't have any evidence about the actual state of the lid. We don't know how long that was unsecured. We don't know if it had always been unsecured. There's just simply no evidence to support the finding that Ms. White was aware that lid was a dangerous situation to her child.
What was the willful act or willful omission that the trial court concluded the defendant did?
So I think it was a combination of factors of taking her prescribed Suboxone and falling asleep with the presence of her nearly six-year-old child that enjoys playing outside near
a septic tank. Basically, the act or omission was falling asleep, knowing that there was, for want of a better term, attractive nuisance in the yard.
Correct. That is my understanding of the court's factual findings.
If that's correct, and my house is on a road that has vehicular traffic, would that be an omission if I fall asleep and my child walks out the house and walks into the street?
And I think, yes, according to the trial court. That's what the trial court is saying, that the mere presence of these items that are possible.
Not from the trial court's analysis, though. He's asking about your analytical framework.
So then, no, I would disagree with that, of course, because the mere possibility of danger is not enough to sustain a conviction under 371.1. Rather, the accused has to be on notice that this is a probable danger to the child. And I think we're now getting into the area of judgment calls when it comes to parenting.
I like your term probable danger. What is the difference between probable danger and an attractive nuisance? Not much.
I don't necessarily agree with that. I think probable danger, and the case law has held this pretty consistently, the parent or the guardian or whoever it is very well on notice of the danger that has been suffered by the child on previous occasions.
Let's go through. The record reflects that your client was aware that Noah was able to unlock the screen door and that he got out.
Correct.
Also, the door to the trailer did not lock properly, and she relied on Noah to lock the screen door behind her when she left, so Noah had some ability to work with the screen door. She testified that there was a problem with the door, but never asked the landlord to fix it. Then she knew that Noah was interested in the septic tank and the area around the septic tank, and she'd seen Noah climb on the lid before, and there was testimony that Noah loved to play outdoors and to climb, and that she knew that his favorite place to play was outside, even in the cold weather. So it's not like we have an isolated circumstance where a child, by happenstance, gets outside, ends up in an area where he or she should not be, and a tragedy occurs. In this circumstance, don't we have some pretty significant facts to suggest that a reasonable person should have been on notice that these things could occur and that her actions in not doing something to prevent it was enough for a fact finder to find willfulness?
Please answer Judge Olson's question, but I want to point out you now in your rebuttal.
Thank you.
This was a very long question.
Yeah. I think Ms. White was on notice of those circumstances that Your Honor just presented, that the child is able to open the door. Again, a child of nearly 6 years old, so a double locked door is not necessarily going to make a difference in this situation. She's on notice that the child enjoys playing in the backyard. This is the backyard to their home. This is not
the septic system.
She's on notice that the child at one point a month or two ago had stood on the lid of the septic tank. This is not notice of probable danger. None of those factors, even combined, viewing the totality of those circumstances, that's not probable danger. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, these are incredibly disturbing facts, and I don't think anybody that read this transcript can't be but touched by the occurrences. But I'd like to take the legal issues out of this factual situation and perhaps put them into a posture, a hypothetical that happens quite a bit, happens a lot. Suppose instead of having a lower income family living in a trailer with a septic tank, suppose we have a middle class mom with a child, lives in a nice neighborhood, has a swimming pool out back. Mom takes some cough syrup that causes her to be drowsy, and she falls asleep, and her child walks out the door, falls in the swimming pool, and drowns. Is that a violation of subsection A of the statute?
I believe the answer to that question depends on the reasonable precautions taken by the mother to avoid that danger, and that's what is missing in this case.
But Isn't that negligence, though? Isn't that negligence rather than willful conduct? Because willful conduct is conduct done for a bad purpose or without justifiable excuse, implying knowledge that a particular conduct will likely result in injury.
And I believe in the Wood case, I think, and I apologize if I'm misciting a case, the court also noted that willfulness inheres in the idea of doing something with reckless disregard to the rights of another. So I submit that there is a recklessness element in there as well.
Well, what is the difference between the reckless disregard for the rights of others and conduct that is gross, wanton, and culpable as to show a reckless disregard for human life?
Well, I think the difference is between just negligence and carelessness and an actual willful act. And here we look at the totality of the circumstances to determine what the willful act or omission was. And here we have some willful acts and we have some willful omissions.
If I fail to watch my child and the child walks out and gets into the swimming pool and drowns, I've been criminally negligent by allowing that to happen. But I certainly did not act willfully in the sense that I wanted something bad to happen, or I turned a blind eye to something bad happening, knowing that it would. There's got to be a difference between willful and criminal negligence.
Well, there is, Judge, and I think that you set upon it when you said turning a blind eye willfully. Because here we have testimony that not only was the defendant aware of this septic tank, I think one of the court earlier referred to as something like an attractive nuisance, like a swimming pool. But we also know that the defendant willfully failed to take any precautions to ensure that her child would stay in the house when he wasn't supervised.
Well, let me first piggyback onto Judge Petty's hypothetical. Mm-hmm. Same hypothetical, except you've sat down with the child and said, you are not to go on the deck of the swimming pool or in the swimming pool unless an adult is present. Okay? You're not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a violation of the statute? And the same drowning occurs. But that's the one precaution I took. I sat down with the child and had the discussion. Is that a violation of the statute?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. It depends on the totality of the circumstances.
Those are all the circumstances.
If those are all the circumstances, I would like to know if the door was locked. Was the door shut in a way that the child could not go outside?
No, because the child can open and close the door.
Okay. Then possibly, yes, Your Honor.
So your view would be that a reasonable fact finder could conclude that arose to the level of criminal responsibility?
Depending on the rest of the circumstances. You know, had the child been playing in and around the pool? Had the child dropped toys in the pool?
If she were not asleep, if she said, go outside in the backyard and play while I'm cooking dinner, is that a violation of the statute if the same thing happens?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. For instance,
could a fact finder conclude it was a violation of the statute under the Commonwealth's theory?
Probably not, Your Honor, because the mother had not absented herself entirely from the child's presence, as we see in the Ellis case. Ellis was under B1, but it's still somewhat a helpful analysis because the court said that the mother had not completely absented herself from the children's presence. The children could holler at her and get her back. She was just a few feet away at the neighbor's house.
This woman was convicted under B1. The question is whether she's also violated A.
Yes, Your Honor.
And B1 only requires criminal negligence. A requires willfulness, something that's got to be higher than criminal negligence, otherwise we have two statutes saying the same thing.
Correct, Your Honor, and I agree with that. However, she took willful acts that were beyond mere negligence.
Is the taking of Suboxone one of the willful acts?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, given the record and the description of the drug in the record, it is basically a drug that doesn't put you to sleep, doesn't put you into a coma, but it makes you drowsy.
Mm-hmm.
So does Benadryl. Are you telling me a single parent risks a criminal conviction if they take Benadryl and their child can open the door to the outside? Because that seems like what the Commonwealth is saying.
No, Your Honor, that's incorrect.
Okay,
respectfully.
And then tell me why that's not the case.
Okay.
Why is that different? Everything else is the same except it's Benadryl.
Okay. In the Duncan case, the Supreme Court stated that in these kinds of cases, you look at the totality of the circumstances, not one solitary circumstance. That is not the analysis. So we look at the combination of the circumstances here. The combination of the circumstances here, and these are very fact-specific cases. This court has been aware of that in the past. These are very fact-specific. So here we have a situation where someone has taken prescription medication or Benadryl and gone back to bed during the day for approximately a three-hour nap. Nothing wrong with that in and of itself. However, we add the circumstance that the defendant was aware that there was a danger in her yard. There was a septic tank that her child had apparently, and this is something that a reasonable fact finder could draw the conclusion from, had played in the septic tank, in or around the septic tank. There were toys in the septic tank. This child had just a month or two before been seen standing on the septic tank by his mother. His mother had told him to get off the septic tank because she was afraid it would crack, showing that she had some comprehension of a danger there. That's something that a reasonable fact finder could find, and that there was absolutely no precaution taken in the home.
So your view that in the context of the specific facts of this case, willfulness to a large degree turns on notice?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, and that's, I believe, in the case law. It's one of the unpublished cases. I didn't cite it in my brief. I think it's Shiflett. Talks about the continuous thread in these kinds of cases that we...
So taking Judge Russell's hypothetical, the mother taking Benadryl without being on notice that there were any inherent dangers or attractive nuisances or anything that could potentially get the child in trouble would probably not be subject to the same culpability.
Yes.
As a parent who maybe knew of the known danger, took no steps to deal with it, was taking prescription medication. In other words, getting into this totality of the circumstances determination. Does this case, in your view, turn on the analytical digestion of the statute, or does it turn on the standard of review?
Well, Judge, it turns on the standard of review. The question in this case is not whether this court agrees with the fact finding. It's whether any reasonable fact finder could look at these circumstances and conclude that they show guilt. On the other hand, you know, what the statute means is inherent to that, and I submit that taking the circumstances in their totality, which is the correct way to analyze this kind of cases, that there is enough that a fact finder could find a willful act.
This was a judge trial, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. It was a bench trial.
And then we go back to the principle that a judge is presumed to know the law.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Everything is the same, except hypothetically, there is no septic tank.
Okay.
However, the house is on a road, and the road has vehicular traffic.
Mm-hmm.
If the child is hurt, everything else happens exactly the same, but the child walks out and is hit by a car. Is that a potential violation of the statute? And in fact, given this circumstance, given that you're saying this was a violation of the statute, is it a violation of the statute? Because, I mean, I think everybody would agree. In fact, I think if you ask most people, vehicular traffic in the street is probably more dangerous than having a septic tank in the backyard.
In this hypothetical, and I'm sorry to ask the court a question, in this hypothetical, is the parent on notice that the child has a proclivity for playing in the street?
Has gone out in the street before.
Okay.
And has almost gotten hit by a car.
No, that's not my hypothetical.
Okay. I'm reserving that hypothetical.
On one prior occasion, the child has walked out into the street and the mother has said, don't do that.
That is Morris, Your Honor. In the Morris case...
Isn't that this case, except on one prior occasion, had been on the septic tank?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor.
But Morris is a B.
Morris is a B.
B1.
It is a B1.
Which is negligence.
It is negligence. This is willfulness. But, and I think that some of the difficulty, and I think that you've picked up on this, obviously, Your Honor, that there's a lot of crisscross in the analysis between A, B1, and the child endangerment statute.
That's why I tried to parse these words and figure out what willful means in one section but doesn't mean in another.
Well, I think the case law defines willful. It defines it as something done with a bad act, with the knowledge that harm can occur, and done in reckless disregard.
Will occur.
And I submit that we have that here.
I mean, it almost seems to me like we're, and we've had a number of these cases, and it almost seems to me like this is almost a an absolute liability case, that if child gets hurt, parent watching child has committed a crime because child got hurt.
I would disagree with that in this case,
Judge. Those of us that have raised children know full well that any time you take an eye off a child for 5 minutes, that child can get hurt. And, you know, that's kind of what happened here. The facts are awful. I can't think of a worse set of facts mm-hmm. to be defending from a defendant's standpoint the statute or the conviction. But it's these attractive nuisances exist everywhere. Every person that has a swimming pool is now under a duty to watch that child 24/7.
I would disagree with that, Judge. I think that the question is what burden is the law going to place on a reasonable citizen, on a reasonable person, and a reasonable parent? No parent can watch a child 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. However, reasonable people take reasonable precautions. And that can include double bolting the door, like was done in Morris. That can include watching the child Barrett.
If I double bolt the door, if I make sure the door is locked, but I know that my child is capable of unlocking that door, how does that make a difference?
Well, Judge, I would go right back to Morris, even though it is a B1 case. There, the court found that the evidence was not sufficient to sustain a conviction because even though these children had gone outside before, the mother took a reasonable precaution before she lay down.
But how is it a reasonable precaution if I know it will not stop that?
She didn't know that it wouldn't stop it. The children got out in Morris, but she had taken the precaution of installing another bolt on the door and lying down. There's a very similar unpublished case where it's Fry. It was unpublished, so I didn't cite it in my brief. But in the Fry case, the defendant there had installed, she knew her children could get out, she had installed a double-sided deadbolt that could only be opened with a key. Her roommate came in late at night, didn't lock that deadbolt, and the child got out. Evidence was insufficient to convict. Here we have someone that is on notice that her child plays in and around the septic tank. I think in your swimming pool, Judge Petty, and swimming pool hypothetical, that would be like a parent who was on notice that her 5-year-old was just fascinated with that swimming pool and was outside all the time.
I think every parent is on notice that a 5-year-old is fascinated with swimming pool.
Sure. And was in that swimming pool all the time and was hanging over the edge and dropping toys into it. Well, then what did the parent do at that point? And I think that's how we police the line.
Is there any evidence of record to suggest how the toys got in there, whether they were flushed or somebody had lifted them up the lid and dropped them in?
There is no direct evidence. I submit that a reasonable fact finder could infer that the toys were dropped in. A 6-inch long action figure was found in the septic tank when the child's body was found and was actually in the body bag with the child's remains. That action figure is too large to flush.
But that, in all probability, occurred when the child fell in, had the toy with him.
Possibly, Your Honor. But that's an inference that a reasonable fact finder could make. A reasonable fact finder could also infer that toy was already in the tank.
How long did it take before the child's remains were found in the septic system?
I believe it was 5 days, Your Honor. 4 or 5 days.
And how long was it before the child was reported missing?
I believe it was within an hour.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I see your firm.
Just want to briefly touch on the Morris case because I believe that was mischaracterized a little bit. There was no evidence in either this court's opinion or the Supreme Court's opinion that double locking the door was actually a safeguard that the mother had taken since the first time the children
escaped the home. And I think that's what the Commonwealth is trying to argue sets this case apart from Morris.
Can I bring you to my analogy about the swimming pool? If a parent has a swimming pool and does not put a fence around it, and the child walks in and drowns, couldn't a trial court conclude that the willful omission was the failure to put the fence around the swimming pool?
No, because then the court is placing an affirmative duty on the defendant to take these protective measures against possible harm, not probable harm. This is, again, a difference in judgment between parents. You can either completely childproof your home and make sure your kid never touches anything.
But in this case, the parent could very well have, realizing that there's this danger that the child is exposed to, she could have taken steps to secure the lid on that so that he couldn't open it, and she didn't do that.
She absolutely could have, but the law does not place an affirmative duty on her. It places an affirmative duty on another person, and that person is actually the holder of the septic tank permit.
Any parent who by willful omission causes or permits serious injury, and the willful omission would be the failure to correct attractive nuisance or to prevent the child from getting into an attractive nuisance.
But willful necessarily requires that she be aware of probable harm.
Judge, can I ask
one last question?
Judge, this question is a very interesting question, and as he asked the question, it made me think of something. I live in a development that has a homeowners association. I'm not very happy about that. But in any event, I live in a homeowners association, and they send out a notice that says, if you are going to put a pool in your backyard, you must put up a fence or a boundary or whatever. And it specifically says, and I recall, because children are attracted to these things, and it could cause danger to a child who could come up to that area because it is not blocked off or something like that. That's the terminology. If I lived in that homeowners association, we had the same circumstance that Judge Petty described, where I was put on notice that this was an attractive nuisance, would that get closer to willfulness or not even suffice?
I would say it would get closer, and I think that's similar to the warnings that the landlord actually had. But again, I don't think that would be sufficient for willfulness, because it's up to you as a parent as to whether you want to sit down with your child and say, please don't go outside alone, please don't touch this, please don't go near the pool, or whether you want to put a fence around your pool.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument. We will greet...